Spirit Blade Underground, episode 332. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 332.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and very unique community you're invited to check out at christiangeekcentral.com. Recording this early in the morning while I'm still froggy. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, to encourage, and to inspire Christian geeks like you and me to hopefully live more and more for Christ. For more information and free goodies, check out spiritblade.net. On the show today, a review for the movie The Maze Runner, and part two of our look at the controversial topic of video game emulation and abandonware. Plus, Ken from Honolulu stops by to review Penelope. All right, let's get to it.
Displacement engines are charged for warp, Captain Franson.
Great, computer. Set a course for the uncharted territories.
By your command. And might I compliment your choice of clothing today?
Oh, thanks. Almost went with the blue shirt, but felt like red at the last minute.
Warning, enemy ships approaching.
Divert power to shields.
Defensive systems malfunctioning.
Oh, what,
overdue
what?
For annual maintenance.
Oh, come on.
Incoming weapons fire.
Evasive maneuvers. Arm the photon torpedo.
Wormhole detected.
What? Wormhole? Where the frizz did that come from?
Critical gravitational damage.
No.
Supernova detected within lethal range.
We've got...
Projected chance of lethality 100%.
What the crap is going on? The Maze Runner. Well, let's see here. Thomas wakes up in an elevator. This is according to the IMDb synopsis. Remembering nothing but his own name, he emerges in a world of about 60 teen boys who have learned to survive in a completely enclosed environment, subsisting on their own agriculture and supplies. A new boy arrives every 30 days. The original group has been in the Glade for 2 years, trying to find a way to escape through the maze that surrounds their living space. They have begun to give up hope. Then, a comatose girl arrives with a strange note, and their world begins to change. All right, so let's talk about the story, the script, the pacing. The story intention in this movie is based on concealing and then slowly revealing information. Kind of like a monster movie, you know, where you've got the threat out there, but you don't really know what the threat is. And then over time, the nature of that threat, the nature of that monster or whatever it is slowly revealed over time. And now there is a monster in this movie, but it's not what I would call a monster movie. It's about them finding themselves in this crazy situation, not remembering anything about their past, and trying to piece together what the heck happened and why they are in this place in the middle of this maze. And for a movie like that, the pacing of how you give out that information, how quickly you give it out, and how quickly you expect your audience to be processing it and keeping up with you, and you know that it can, if you do that wrong, then that can really screw up your movie. If your audience ever gets bored, or if the audience ever gets ahead of you, you're in big trouble. And I didn't find that to be true in my experience of The Maze Runner. I felt that the info, the pace at which they were giving it out to me was really good. The dialogue side of the script, it's mostly solid, but sometimes cliche and often uninteresting by itself. I want to be clear, by itself. I think the dialogue in this, if you're just looking at the written page, probably isn't all that captivating, but the subtext is what and the performances are what drive these scenes forward, not so much the dialogue that's actually coming out of their mouths. And so while we're on the topic, let's talk about the cast, the performances. Dylan O'Brien, who I didn't know from anything, I had to look up online. Apparently this guy is from Teen Wolf. I did see a little while back, there was, you know, like I think I tried out half of an episode, and I'm like, oh crap. crap. This is so not my kind of show. It's like a, it's not on the CW, but it's a very CW-y feeling kind of, I think it's like an MTV show or something like that, about a bunch of pretty boys who are werewolves or something. I don't know. Anyway, but Dylan O'Brien from Teen Wolf is Thomas in this movie, the male lead. And despite having the background of being in a show like Teen Wolf, he was a very relatable character, I felt. Not because he was, like, in particularly representing the everyman, but maybe just because he wasn't model posing, which, you know, you happen, which I happen to find really frustrating when I watch, like, a CW show, and I see that a lot, what I call, like, model posing. They get these really beautiful people in there, and they're having their dramatic moments, and they're, it's just all very contrived and terrible, and which is why I really want to like Arrow, but I don't at this point. I'm going to give it a try this fall, but we'll see. Anyway, but there was no model posing coming from Dylan O'Brien, which I really appreciated. Really no model posing from anybody, despite having a very young cast of up-and-coming actors. Thomas Brody Sangster, this is a guy whose face you'll recognize, but you might not know what he's from. He's been in a bunch of things. The first thing I think he was known for was Nanny McPhee. He was one of the kids in, like, the first Nanny McPhee movie. And he's been in other stuff since then. I found out on IMDb he's on Game of Thrones, which I don't watch, but I'm sure that probably is what's kind of giving him a step into big movies like The Maze Runner, being on a show like that. And then Will Poulter was another one that I was like, oh, I know that face. I know that face. Where have I seen him? And he was Eustace, I think is the name of the character, in The Chronicles of Narnia, Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I think Eustace is the name. He's a really obnoxious kid. Anyway, but I was just trying to figure out, where have I seen that kid? And, like, most of these kids are all British actors, half of which are doing American accents. And, man, that aside, the accent thing aside, I don't know why, you know, American actors have so many problems with accents, but yet Brits and Australians and stuff, they do these rockin' amazing American accents you couldn't tell the difference in. But accent skills aside, these are solid actors, solid performances. And they have interesting faces, which is a hot commodity in Hollywood for decades now. And that's why I suspect that what we're seeing in this movie is a possible showcase of tomorrow's stars. Because, like I said, they're solid actors and they have interesting faces, and that's really important on the screen. So take note of the cast here. It'll be interesting to see where they all go in the future. Another thing related to the casting and the direction specifically is that I don't think these actors were asked to do something they couldn't do. One of my pet peeves, I just finished binge watching season 4 of The Walking Dead, and they had a couple of young actresses in that show that I think were asked to do some things that where they were at in terms of their skill level, in terms of their life experience, they weren't able to convincingly, in my mind, bring to the screen. You know, there was just kind of like some kid acting going on. I think you really got to shy away from asking child actors, unless they are, like, freaking amazing, you know, once-in-a-lifetime Dakota Fanning types. I think you got to shy away from asking your young actors to handle these really heavy emotions and crying and stuff like that, you know, because some kids, they just can't do it, you know, and that's, you know, that's not a slam on them so much as I think it's a slam on the scripting. And, you know, if you're going to write that kind of script, you probably shouldn't even attempt it unless you have a Dakota Fanning type. But this script didn't ask for those kinds of scenes. Despite that, I was really emotionally invested in the characters, maybe because the actors were not asked to go, you know, in these crazy, heavy emotional directions. There's one kid in particular, the character's name is Chuck, who was a very endearing character and had a scene that actually brought me to tears, even though he as an actor and as a character was not required in that scene to produce tears, you know, and to really go to a heavy emotional place. And so I think this, I guess bottom line, what I'm saying is this movie and this script and this director seem to know how to use younger actors in a way that's more realistic, I guess, for lack of a better word, and compelling and makes them easy to invest in. Yeah, just really, really great use of this kind of young cast. And on that note, I should say that I am so sick of these, you know, young adult novel adaptation movies. I mean, it started with Twilight, which really got us off to a rough start, you have to admit. admit. And then you've got The Host, you've got Divergent, you've got I just saw The Giver, you know. I'm just getting tired of these things where they cast these, you know, these pretty boy and pretty girl kind of, you know, model types. It's all very CW feeling. And there was very little of that going on in this movie. This movie was a little bit more in the vein of Hunger Games, where it was based on a young adult property, but it's presented in a way that's appealing to, I think, people that are not necessarily into that kind of fiction. It's just a cast that happens to be at that kind of certain age, that young adult coming of age type stage of life, you know. But otherwise, it didn't feel like this young adult, you know, type of story. And so I really enjoyed that about it. There was no, like, you know, cheesy, very shallow romance type stuff. Gosh, I just watched the first 20 minutes of Divergent. No, not the first 20 minutes. I gave Divergent, I think, 2/3 of my time of the movie to watch. And anyway, this just isn't like that. It's very enjoyable for people who don't like those kinds of stories. Let's talk about CGI. Okay, well, CGI looks like CGI. Now, they do some good things. They use some shaky cam to hide the CGI quality, which isn't bad. I'm just cursed with an eye that really picks out CGI easily. It's like, yeah, that obviously is not a practical effect. That obviously is CGI, you know. And so for me, you know, that was like, okay. But shaky cam helped. Oh, but they used a little too much shaky cam sometimes. It's, you know, it's a little too much like bouncy cam, like, what the crap is going on? And, you know, maybe when I've got it home on Blu-ray and the screen's a little bit smaller, it's not my entire field of vision that they're, you know, taking up. Maybe it'll work a little bit better for me. But as it was in the theater, I was like, whoa, can we, like, just settle down and, you know, let's get some steady cam action going on there, you know? But anyway, I think that the editing and the direction in the movie help the stunts and the visuals and bring intensity to the experience. So it's not just visual effects that make this movie, like, intense and crazy and cool. I think the editing and the direction really helped that quite a bit. I do wish there was a greater variety of creatures in the maze. There's basically one creature in the maze that they have to deal with, one type of creature, and I wish there were more. The obstacles were interesting and surprising at times, so that aspect of the maze was very cool and like, what the crap, and very, you know, riveting and intense, you know. So that was neat stuff. As far as music and sound go, the score I found forgettable, but it does the important job of enhancing emotion. I don't need to hum your themes when I'm driving home, but I do want your score to help me feel what I'm supposed to feel in the story. There was also a few great sound design choices that, in the absence of visuals, because remember, in this movie, they're not giving us all the information right away. They're hiding a lot of information and just dealing it out slowly over time. And so they leave a lot of the visuals to your imagination for a while until they're ready to show those cards. But in the meantime, they use sound design to help your imagination kind of go, what the crap is that, you know, and wonder what you're going to see around the next corner. You know, it stimulates the imagination and the fear of the unknown, so that really worked for me. Now, what in terms of philosophical or moral relevance, you know, might this movie have to stimulate conversation or thought about? Well, not a whole lot, I don't think. There's an interesting phrase, wicked is good, in the movie, which is related to the initials WCKD. And that's, I won't go into the story about what that's, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but I do think that's an interesting phrase. Wicked is good. That's something that the characters are asked to accept. And I'll let you, when you watch the movie, see that it's not exactly what it sounds like when I say it. But, anyway, yeah, that was interesting. We'll see where that goes in future movies, because this is clearly a story that is going to be told in multiple parts. That's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. So if you want to wait till the whole story is done, if you're that type, just wait on this one. But let's see here. There's another idea presented in the movie, that what they did, what all these young adults did before having their memories wiped, it doesn't matter, that those people don't exist anymore. And that was specifically in the context of bad things that they had done. You know, one character's trying to console another and saying, listen, whatever you did in the past, it doesn't matter, that person doesn't exist anymore. And I find that interesting, you know. What are we going to say the same thing about mean drunks? You know, I know when I was talking to a friend a while back about, like, you know, how he'll hang out with friends and they'll kind of be drinking and one of them be a jerk and stuff like that, you know, and they'll do something or they'll say something that's really horrible and they just kind of let it go, you know. And I said, well, well, why don't you, like, you know, sit and have a talk with them, you know, later on? He's like, you know, everybody knows they were drunk. It's not that big of a deal, you know. And, you know, I'm just thinking to myself, well, they chose to drink that alcohol, and they chose to get themselves in that kind of state so that they might be doing those kinds of things. You know, are they not responsible anymore just because they don't remember doing that thing? You know, so, you know, I guess that brings to mind the question, if no one remembers that something evil happened, does that evil no longer require justice? And maybe in a world where there is no superior all-knowing being that holds everyone accountable, that would be true. But I mean, if you believe that there is a God who is, you know, aware of everything and is going to ultimately hold everybody to account, well, then, you know, it's not so easy to say, well, we don't remember that, so it's not a problem that it happened, you know. I don't know. There's probably some more thinking and more factors involved in there that I haven't quite considered yet, but it was something that jumped out to me as being worthy of further thought. But, I did have to search for those things, though. I think mostly this movie's just interesting, intense, and a fun experience. It's not going to be something that's going to leave you going, yeah, let me think about my life a little bit more. It's not really that kind of thing. In summary, if I were talking to myself about this movie, I would say, you know, listen, Peter, you can wait and rent this one, but don't miss it. Put it on your agenda at some point, or as soon as it comes out in Redbox, bring it home and check it out, because it's a great evening of fun in your living room. It's a well-made sci-fi suspense flick. It's rated PG-13 for thematic elements and intense sequences of sci-fi violence and action, including some disturbing images. I give it a quality score of 8.5 out of 10 and a relevant score of 7.0 out of 10. I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more info about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Every day, somewhere in the world, a movie is slipping through the cracks. Every year, hundreds are lost and forgotten. But one man refuses to let them fall into darkness. One man risks everything to bring them back into the light. That man is Ken from Honolulu.
Hello, this is Ken from Honolulu with a movie review. This review contains spoilers. The movie is Penelope, made in 2006. Directed by Mark Polanski, starring Catherine O'Hara as Jessica Wilhern and Christina Ricci as Penelope Wilhern. There's several other people who you would know playing in this, but they played minor roles. Synopsis: a modern romantic tale about a young aristocratic heiress born under a curse that can only be broken when she finds true love with the one who will love her faithfully until death do us part. Review. I give this movie a 8 out of 10 because it is a fairly well-made movie. The acting is well done and is done in a style that is very believable. I give this a relevant score of 7. However, the relevant score is not for religious reasons. It's because there is a lot to talk about, and especially for young girls. This movie is aimed at girls between the ages of, I'd say, 11 and 14 at the upper end. If you've ever read the fairy tale Ugly Duckling, that's what this is from. This is quite similar to that. It's about a young girl who has a pig nose. She's born with a curse that gives her a pig's snout and ears. And she's never allowed to go outside. Her mother is very loving, very caring, and doesn't allow her to go outside so she won't be ridiculed. To break the curse, she has to marry another aristocrat. Well, the problem with that is that every time they see her, they run screaming in terror. If any of you listening to this are young women, or women in general, and grew up with a feature of your body that you didn't like, Or if you have a daughter that has a feature of her body that she doesn't like. For my daughter, it was her hair. Couldn't stand it. Then you will understand the premise of this film very quickly. She's supposed to have this pig nose, and it terrifies people that see her for whatever reason is not given. But that's not the idea. The idea is that she doesn't like who she is. She doesn't like what she is. Doesn't like who she looks like. Her mother is a caricature of a loving mother, of course. This is a fantasy film. And Penelope is played by Christina Ricci, who was Wednesday in the Addams Family movies with Raul Julia and Angelica Houston. The mother is the woman who played Winona Ryder's mother in Beetlejuice. And it's almost a similar type of role in this, except she's not as neurotic in this film. She shows that she does love her daughter. She doesn't want her daughter to be hurt. She doesn't want her daughter to be ridiculed. So she's a loving mother, just a very strange loving mother. The father, he's a caring father, and he plays a minor role in this because this is a chick flick. This is not an action movie. There is no sex, there is no violence, and there is no cussing. It's a movie if you want to have your kids sit down and watch it just without you being there, then it's a good movie for that, because unlike other movies and other things that are in today's society, they don't say, well, because you're ugly, go out and have just unlimited amounts of sex with whoever comes along, or because you're ugly, dress like some skank so that they're not going to look at the ugly part and they're going to look at the part you want them to look at. In this movie, Penelope dresses very conservatively. All of her dresses and skirts come down to at least her knees, and she's almost always wearing stockings. So she's, and her clothes come up to her, almost to her chin. So she's dressed very conservatively. After she meets her Prince Charming and he tells her he can't marry her, but doesn't tell her why, she goes ahead and she leaves the house that she's never left in, say, like 25 years or so. Doesn't know how the world works exactly. She's got a good idea. She meets people that like her and care for her for who she is, not for what she looks like. But then again, she meets people who are fans. They want to take pictures, and all of the news people are there after she passes out and she goes to the hospital. The news people are there, and she finds out that she has fans, people that want to see her and make her popular. Eventually, she hooks up again with Prince Charming, and everybody lives happily ever after. There are some plot twists and some interesting things that are going on. This is not just for children. Adults can find it entertaining also, because there are some adult jokes, and I don't mean crude or anything, but they're oriented for adult minds that adults will get that the kids won't get. And it is a charming little film. It's a movie that I recommend for girls and adults, but boys will be thoroughly bored because this is a chick flick. So, thank you for listening to my review. This is Ken from Honolulu. Aloha!
There is a world of geekiness out there I'd love to feature more of on the show. If you'd like to contribute a review, news, or other geekery of any kind, go to spiritblade.net/submissions or shoot me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. And lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
This week, I'm taking a break from examining a specific passage of the Bible, and I'm instead going to touch on something that I think is relevant to a lot of us geeks while using the Bible to inform my thinking. So today I want to talk about video game emulation and abandonware. This is part two of an examination of video game emulation in an effort to answer the question, should Christians use emulators or abandonware? To answer this question, I think there are four key elements to consider. Number one, is console game emulation legal? Or I should add into that, I suppose, is playing abandonware games legal? And number two, what does the Bible say about our obligation to obey man-made laws? And number three, to what standard are we held accountable in our obedience to man-made laws and or the Bible? And finally, number four, what are the consequences for Christians who disobey man-made laws or commands of Scripture? Well, in part one, I did the best I could to examine the issue from the legal side of things and concluded that playing unofficially emulated or abandonware games is illegal in almost every case. The best case scenario I can come up with for being able to play such games legally is if you personally own the original game and you personally created the backup copy, so you didn't download it from online, and you are playing it on an emulator that does not use any code from the BIOS of the original console. But I can't even confirm that that scenario would be 100% legal. So even in this best case scenario, proceed with caution. Hang on, I better get a drink here. All right, excuse me. In all other cases, you're violating the law if you play emulated or abandonware games. Now, I've enjoyed playing a number of emulated games and some abandonware as well. So for me, that's a tough pill to swallow. But maybe it shouldn't be, right? I mean, how important is it really for us as Christians to obey the laws of corrupt man-made government? Especially laws like this that may seem extremely stupid and pointless at times. What does the Bible have to say about Christians and their relationship to man-made laws and governments? Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 5 in the ESV reads, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience." In Romans 13, 1 through 5, the Apostle Paul teaches that Christians should submit to the authorities over them, specifically the government. The primary reason is that all authority structures and figures are put in place by God, according to what he wants to accomplish on earth in the short or the long term. Now look at verse 1. And then also you can look at Romans 8:28, which I think supports that idea. Governing authorities are even called the servants of God. In Romans 13:4, we see, and this is surprising since we know from experience that many of our leaders and lawmakers, they're not Christians, and they also make and enforce some laws that are flawed. Despite the shortcomings of man-made rulers and man-made laws, however, they still serve God's overall plans. In fact, even their shortcomings and failures will serve God's ultimate agenda to bring about the best possible outcome. God has a history of using unbelieving or corrupt leaders to bring about his will. You can look at Jeremiah 25, verse 9, and Isaiah 45, verses 1 through 6, for examples of that. God is also in the business of using flawed or even evil choices to bring about the best possible good. Joseph tells his brothers who betrayed him, he says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." And that's from Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. I read it from the ESV. And let's go ahead and jump back to Romans 8:28, which I mentioned earlier. In the ESV, it reads, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." When we ignore laws our governments have put in place, we're actually ignoring the authority that God has put in place. We can't easily separate disobedience to government from disobedience to God. Now, copyright laws may seem little or inconsequential. Breaking copyright law in the privacy and secrecy of our homes may seem like a victimless crime. It may seem like many people, including those charged with enforcing these laws, don't really care about them or view them as important, but it doesn't change the fact that they are laws established by authorities that God has placed over us. Disregarding these laws isn't just brushing off the man. It's brushing off Yahweh. It's brushing off the God of the universe. And the consequences or punishments that may follow are a part of God's response. And I think that's indicated in Romans 13, 2. We're not permitted to pick and choose which laws we want to follow based on our own ideas of how good or how vital, how important each law is. The only exception we see in Scripture is when a man-made law or authority demands that we disobey a command of God. And examples of that can be found in Daniel 3, 28, Daniel 6, 6 through 10, Acts 4, 19, and Acts 5, 29. Now, if I'm honest with myself and if I'm transparent with you, then I have to admit that when I'm faced with a choice to obey or to disobey, and it feels to me like the choice to disobey has little consequence or won't really hurt anyone, I sometimes tell myself, hey, remember, I mean, you're forgiven. Your sins of the past, present, and future, they're all dealt with, including the sin that you're about to choose right now. So just, you know, just do it and just gain that satisfaction you want. You've had a rough day, and choosing this will make you feel just that much better. It's not that big a deal. Or is it? If believers in Jesus have no reason to ever fear eternal punishment, why obey? Are there any consequences in this life or in eternity choosing obedience or disobedience? And what about disobeying stupid little laws like those related to copyright? How good, you know, exactly are we supposed to be as Christians? Doesn't all this smell like just religious legalism? Well, we're going to take a look at those questions next time in part 3. Feedback, input, I want to hear from you. Request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, whatever. It all helps me make this show better. So please go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer if you have one for me, or send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. Well, guys, I want to greatly expand the number of Christian geek voices that are being represented at ChristianGeekCentral.com. So if you'd be interested in helping to provide content for the Christian Geek Central website or for the channel, and promoting your own site or channel at the same time, please email me for more information at paeter@spiritblade.net. I also want to remind you guys about Christian Geek Central's participation in the Extra Life charity event at the end of October. October 25th is the official day, but you don't have to participate on that day if that doesn't work out for you. This is an event to raise money for children who need medical care whose families cannot otherwise afford it without the money gained from charities like this one. So, just as an update, no one has signed up to join the Christian Geek Central team yet, so I'm feeling like an especially huge nerd and dork right now, all by my lonesome, trying to do this cool thing, and nobody really seems interested in doing this cool thing with me, so maybe I'll just do it by myself. No, please, please join me. So I want to add some thoughts for your consideration as you weigh your potential involvement in this event. If the idea of a 24-hour gaming marathon, because that's what this is by default, it's a 24-hour gaming marathon in which you ask for people to show tangible support through a one-time gift of like $10 or $20, with the goal of everyone raising $100 or maybe a $200 if you can. But the default goal, I think initially when I talked about this, I said $200, but it's actually $100 as I looked on the website. But I'm still hoping that we as a community can combined raise a total of $1,000 for this cause. So anyway, if the idea of, you know, doing a 24-hour gaming marathon is imposing or just plain unrealistic for you, given your schedule or your family situations, I want you to know that you can still absolutely be a part of the CGC Extra Life team. The marathon is, it's the gimmick. It's not the core of what this event is about. So if you can't do 24 consecutive hours, then split it up over multiple days over the course of a month. And if that's still too much, just do 12 hours and split it up if you like. Another option, if that's still too much, would be to host a gaming night in your home as an Extra Life fundraiser on behalf of the Christian Geek Central team, asking attendees to consider donating as a part of that event. I mean, there are so many ways that you can go about participating. The 24-hour marathon is just the default. So if that's seeming like it's just not going to work with your schedule or your life situation, then there's a bunch of other ideas. I'll even brainstorm with you, you know. The main thing we want to do is be getting donations, inviting people to be a part of this cause. Frankly, you don't even need to pick up a controller or roll any dice to join the CGC team. Now, of course, I think that's kind of missing the fun part, but it's still not vital. The most important thing for Christian Geek Central Extra Life team members is their willingness to invite others to participate in tangibly blessing children who need medical care they can't afford. And as a reminder, Extra Life has a really nice form email that you can use if you feel uncomfortable writing or talking to others. Now, I know participating in something like this on any level takes some stretching and rearranging of life. But you know what? With my voice alone, we're never going to reach the goal I've set for the Christian Geek Central team of $1,000. However, with just a few people helping me, we may be able to reach that goal or even shatter it. That's what I would really love to see happen. You know, some people would say that geeks are... that we're, you know, we're self-absorbed people who kind of obsess over our hobbies off in a corner somewhere, and we don't really have our feet in the real world. And you know, maybe that's true of us sometimes. Either way, you know, I don't think we need to justify ourselves to other people, and I want to be clear that participating or not participating in an event like this does not make us more or less valuable people. It doesn't make us more or less committed to following Christ. But, you know, it is one way that you and I can practice looking outside of ourselves, as sometimes as geeks we have trouble doing, I'll be the first to admit, and to develop the ability to embrace inconvenience in service to others. So I would really love it if you would encourage being a part of the Christian Geek Central Extra Life team. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask me. You can also find more info and sign up for the CGC Extra Life team on the CGC Extra Life page. You'll find that link in the main navigation at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Thanks very much for your consideration, guys. On a related note, I want to remind you guys again that my second live game stream in preparation for the 24-hour live game stream for Extra Life is going to be Monday, September 29th. I'm going to stream myself playing video games live on Twitch for 3 hours again. I did this about a month ago. I'm doing this one more time. I just want to try and work out the kinks. I anticipate that a lot more kinks will be worked out this time. There were a few, but I still had a good time gaming. So I hope you'll join me Monday, September 29th at ChristianGeekCentral.com or on the Twitch channel Christian Geek Central, one word. That's from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific. 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific, Christian Geek Central on Twitch or ChristianGeekCentral.com, Monday the 29th. All right, well, I want to thank Ken from Honolulu for the review of Penelope. I love how Ken just, like, finds these little gems that we tend... Like, I saw a trailer for Penelope years ago when it originally came out, and I was like, well, that's interesting. It had a little bit of geek appeal, you know, but I wasn't sure, you know, how much or, like, you know, if I would like it or not. So it was kind of like it was a low priority. And so I think there's, you know, those movies that, you know, as the intro for Ken's segment says, they kind of slip through the cracks a little bit. And so... thank you, Ken, for just bringing those gems to life. Well, sometimes they're not always gems, but I really appreciate you highlighting them and drawing attention to them because they're usually some really interesting movies. So thank you again, Ken, for that. Guys, stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning next week if God wants it to happen. Gosh, what is happening next week? Hold on a second. Oh, that's right. We've got some TV show premieres to talk about. We've got the Gotham TV series premiere that I'll look forward to talking about next week. And I'm also planning to give Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. another shot. I'm going to give them one episode to get me back in because I just wasn't happy with what they've done so far. And this is their shot to get me back in. I really want to love that show. I want to even just like it. So we'll see what happens there. Till then, thanks so much for making time for this show, guys. I hope you have a great week and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Friends and with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
Okay, episode 201 of Farscape, Mind the Baby. Farscape is like comfort food to me sometimes. I'm sitting here ending my night, and I've gotten nailed by a nasty flu a couple days ago, and I just felt like putting in some Farscape, and I almost didn't do it because up to this point, I've kept a notepad next to me to kind of jot down some thoughts as I write episodes, and you know, and then I've also got this recording that I do afterward, which usually amounts to around 10 minutes, give or take. And every once in a while, I'll feel like watching Farscape and just say, ah, but I don't feel like doing the work attached to it since I'm doing Farscape Shawarma. But this time I thought, you know, I want Farscape, and I'll just kind of fly by the seat of my pants with the recording afterwards, so that's what you're going to get. There's not a whole lot that actually happens over the course of this episode. The status quo doesn't change until, you know, I guess the very end, with Krace taken off with Talon. There's some interesting things going on with the characters. I'll start with Zan, because I don't like Zan. I don't like her in this episode. Both Virginia Hayes' performance wasn't connecting with me. It, for some reason, it seemed put on or something. I don't know. I mean, she has some really good episodes. To me, it's clear that she doesn't have the kind of acting background that the other cast members do. But nevertheless, there were still some interesting things going on with her character. She's doing this Delvian Seek. And, you know, this originally was not the first episode of season two. There was another episode that they, before they found, reconnected with John, and they kind of, they shot a new opening and ending to that original first episode and then put it later in the season as a flashback. Without that, I think it's the right choice because they wanted to get back into the action. They wanted to get back into reuniting the crew. And I get that, you know, and I think they made the right choice. But without that episode, you don't understand what Zan has been going through, because that episode is, if I remember correctly, is about Zan and kind of like the loss she felt, the responsibility she felt, the guilt she feels at the end of that episode over the loss of John and Dargo. And so it leads more easily into this episode, where she's like manic and like lost her mind at the beginning of this episode, which was, I didn't buy that. It didn't feel right. But anyway, interesting things going on with Zan though. You know, she's pursuing this Seek, and she, which is, you know, I've said before that she seems inspired off of like a Buddhist monk, and Buddhism is very much about this kind of separation from the physical world, and detachment is a big idea in Buddhism, and she's clearly displaying that, and you know, pursuing this really, you know, pious spirituality and stuff like that, but she's completely disconnected from the people that are right around her that need her, and so it's interesting that they would, I think, rightfully identify that kind of spiritualism as selfish, you know. Yet we in American pop culture, seem to highly regard Buddhism, or, certainly put it up there on equal footing with, the values of Christianity. The values of Christianity taken from scripture are all about selflessness. They're not about detachment from people. They're about investing in people and sacrificing for people. And so I thought she was very rightfully called out, and, I thought it was, you know, neat that she kind of recognized that at the end. Let's see what else. Dargo, new makeup, like the new makeup. Still some good interplay going on with him and John. Not a lot of character stuff that I recall for Dargo this episode, but the dialogue I just love. The dialogue in this episode I thought was really great, really witty, really revealing about the characters and their thoughts and motives and stuff. So I enjoyed that. Let's see. Chiana didn't have much to do in this episode, except for a, you know, really obvious wire jump. let's see. Rigel had a fun little character moment where he was kind of getting choked up, as it were, because of the emotion of seeing John and Aaron again. Let's see. What else? Oh yeah, Crace, and just kind of getting a sense of where he's going. And the whole, I guess, Talon and Aaron, and I like the way Aaron interacts with Talon. The softness that Claudia Black brings to that, and so I just appreciated them kind of setting up some of the threads that are, you know, going to carry on from here regarding Crace and Talon and the relationship there, and I think that's it. Yeah, this is probably a lot shorter without my notes, but I'm also feeling sick, so cut me some slack. All right, so next episode. Oh, really? That's a second season episode? Okay, Vitas Mortis. I remember having some issues with this one. I mean, it's a decent episode that I remember, but I think it was a choice of dubbing. I don't know. We'll find out next time. But anyway, that's it for this time.